Race of My Life, presented by Autosport.
There are lots of exciting races you have in a career in motor racing, but there are very few that have the same significance as 1994 Suzuka had for me. With the deaths of Roland Ratzenberger and Ayrton Senna, 1994 was a highly stressful and dramatic year. Everything seemed to have much more emphasis. To stay in the championship fight, I had to win. There was a great deal of expectation on the part of Michael Schumacher and Benetton that they were going to sew it up in Japan. Most people thought it would end there. These are the words of 1996 Formula One world champion Damon Hill describing the importance of the 1994 Japanese Grand Prix, which he won for Williams. This pick is the latest in our Race of My Life miniseries. I'm your host, Alex Kalanorkas, Autosport's Grand Prix editor, and with me for today's special episode are two guests. The first is GP Racing editor Ben Anderson, who conducted the interview with Damon Hill for the Race of My Life feature that went into Autosport magazine 10 years ago. Good morning, Ben. How are you? And I believe this is your first appearance on our Race of My Life podcast.
Hi, Alex. Yes, it is. Yeah. Thanks for having me on. They've let me out of the cupboard, ready to do this very special podcast. Thanks for having me.
No worries. Well, welcome to you. And my second guest, I'm delighted to say, is the man himself, Damon Hill. Damon, welcome to the Race of My Life podcast. How are you doing?
I'm well, thanks very much, Alex. And well, it's all being conducted under the sort of easing of the lockdown, if I can reveal that. You know, that's where we are in time. So we've all been locked up, plenty of time to think about Formula One and the history of Formula One, and a lot of reviewing going on of past races, because we haven't got any new ones to talk about.
Absolutely. No, we are indeed recording remotely, and I'm delighted to say, not that unfortunately the listeners will be able to see this, but I can see a copy a cover of Autosport behind you over your shoulder, which is particularly cool. Yeah, the champion edition.
That's very good. Obviously very much cherished. It was the one where you do a special edition when someone has become a champion. And so it's got a green title at the top of it, and it's in very garish fluorescent colours, which I was told, was assured that would boost sales in those days. They said it stood out on the shelf, but I don't think we bother that anymore, do we? I don't know. You can tell me.
No, things are a little bit more refined on Autosport. But Ben, you're the magazine editor. Would you go for such garish colours these days?
Probably not these days. I think that was a particularly psychedelic time in Autosport's history. Experimental.
We are here to discuss a race 2 years earlier at the same track at Suzuka, Japan, 1994. So I thought, just before we get into the nuts and bolts of the race itself, which was very dramatic, very interesting, appalling conditions in the wet weather at Suzuka, I thought I'd just give a quick summary of where things stood ahead of the race, which is that the 1994 season, Michael Schumacher had been dominant for Benetton early on. We had, of course, the tragedy of Imola, as Damon, you mentioned in your words in the Race of My Life feature at the beginning of this episode, losing Roland Ratzenberger and Ayrton Senna. You, of course, won in Spain for Williams and at Silverstone, where Michael Schumacher, there was the famous incident of overtaking on the parade lap, ignoring or not coming in time for the penalty, being disqualified for ignoring the black flag. And then he was banned for two races, which became later on Italy and Portugal after racing under appeal. You won those races and the championship fight came close together. But then Schumacher, of course, won on his return of the European Grand Prix at Jerez. And that set up a very important race for you at Suzuka, because effectively you had to win the race, or at least certainly not finish the race, to stay in title contention, because if you hadn't scored, Schumacher would have wrapped up the championship in Japan. So a lot of pressure on you going into the weekend. And obviously there'd been quite a few team changes already that season, with obviously after the tragedy of losing Ayrton Senna, you had David Coulthard, Nigel Mansell had been brought in. So it was fair to say a turbulent time arriving in Japan.
Yeah, it was tense. That's one way of describing it. There was a chance to stop the Benetton-Schumacher steamroller. We had been steamrolled in Jerez, I think it was the European Grand Prix. But that was down to I looked pretty defeated, and they looked pretty triumphant after that race. But it later transpired that there was a problem with the fuel rig. And I'd been carrying around an extra load of fuel, which basically affected the performance. So we could have done a lot better in Jerez, but it was a problem that was... So I had my own issues with the team, where I confronted Frank and Patrick about this and say, you know, they were a bit disgruntled that I didn't do so well. And I had to I had to go and meet them and say, you do know why I didn't do well, don't you? It's because you you basically added about 30 kilos of weight to my car, and I couldn't go any faster. So it was tense within the team, as well as they're a very competitive outfit. They don't like to look silly, and I think I got the sense that they'd given up on me, and that's because partly that was exacerbated by the fact they kept bringing Nigel Mansell back to do the business. And I'm not in any way detracting from Nigel Mansell's power and, of course, his experience in the team, but it was kind of undermining for me to be racing against Michael or trying to take the title fight to Michael and constantly having a substitute brought back in to try and shore up the team. So I went to Japan feeling a mixture of determined to do as well as I could, but also feeling under-supported in my attempts to do so by the team.
Bringing in Ben here, we know it was a very wet weekend in 1994, and that's something you had experience of. Was it last year with the typhoon causing all sorts of difficulties for everyone at Suzuka?
Yeah, we got trapped in that, and they cancelled qualifying day and moved qualifying to the Sunday morning. A truncated weekend, occupational hazard at that race, I think, and the conditions particularly terrible in 94 for the race we're discussing. And I think that's what I find particularly impressive about this performance, because Damon touched on the atmosphere at the team. Obviously, it was a very challenging season for Williams and Formula One in general. But I always felt subsequently that as Damon said, he never really had the support of the team. Renault wanted Mansell in. Frank agreed with them. You've got this title fight that you're trying to wage against Benetton, who are really on the up. Schumacher's emerging as a potential dominant force within the championship. You can't really afford to have any infighting or people not really being 100% all aligned in their objectives. And yet you've then got to go to this race in terrible, atrocious weather and find a way to beat Schumacher, who we know is already becoming one of the star wet weather drivers of Formula One, and find a way to beat him. So, where did that come from, Damon?
Imagine, or put yourself in the Benetton camp. Imagine Michael Schumacher agreeing to have one of his rivals drafted in to shore up their efforts in their title fight against me. I mean, Michael would never have stood for it. I never quite got that, won this argument with Williams about when to apply a fair fight within a team between teammates and when to back your lead driver. I mean, Nigel, I then had basically going into Suzuka, I had to beat Michael Schumacher and Nigel Mansell. It's like, okay, guys, thanks a lot. I love Nigel and I'm a big fan of Nigel, and he's awesome. There's no two ways about it. He's box office, and I understand that. But the timing could have been better. But maybe it inspired me. Some people took the view that it inspired me more to beat Michael. I just didn't need that extra motivation. But that's the way this sport goes.
Indeed. And how did the weekend unfold sort of weather-wise? I know it's very British and silly to talk about the weather all the time, but as we've alluded to, it can suddenly just change massively in Japan. So how did qualifying and practice go, and then everything sort of got worse ahead of the race?
I think you can correct me, because you probably got the data in front of you, but I seem to remember I did qualify ahead of Nigel.
Yes, second behind Schumacher.
So I qualified ahead of Nigel, but I had Patrick came up to me after qualifying and said, Nigel's 30 kilometer an hour quicker than you through 130R or something like that. So I'm just going, but I out-qualified him. And I don't know whether he was trying to suggest that I would have been on pole position if I'd done what Nigel had done. But I seem to remember, in my mind, I remember Nigel going to Suzuka in with a chance of winning the title, and he lost it in qualifying and hurt his back, and he never actually made it to the race, I don't think. So, I always took the approach as a driver that, you go as fast as you can to survive, to get to the race. I mean, I didn't want to, put myself in jeopardy. So I qualified well enough to put myself in with the chance of fighting. But that's the kind of pressure you get in Williams.
And then race day arrives, and I was watching, I rewatched the race last night, and the BBC coverage. I mean, it's almost near darkness from what you can see from the cameras back then, and absolutely soaking conditions. The lights go out, eventually, I'm gonna sort of skip back in a second. When you get to turn one, you said all the flash bulbs go off of people taking photos, just it lit everything up eerily. But even before you'd got there, Michael Schumacher had come right across on the line. There's some discussion on the BBC coverage when I was rewatching it about apparently he got some wheel spin and that made it look more aggressive than it actually maybe was. But what was your perspective of the start? Because obviously, as we go on to see in Michael's career, it becomes a bit of a feature, that aggressive chop at the start.
You know, you've got to have all of your senses working when you're racing against Michael. And this is pre-Adelaide, of course, which is the following race. So, but we knew that he was an aggressive driver. But, you know, I always take the view, you have to have an open mind completely. You can't have a strategy going into the first corner. You kind of work out, well, if I'm ahead, I'll do this. And if he comes across in front of me, I'll just slot in behind. But you're right, difficult getting off the line, and defensive driving at the start is not unusual. What was astonishing, as you mentioned earlier, that the darkness had descended, and what completely surprised me but was absolutely fantastic as an experience, which still amazes me today, is that when we went down to the first corner, the whole of that grandstand at the first corner, which when you're in a racing car, it sort of comes and towers over you, and it's like you're driving into an arena. It all lit up because in those days they didn't have phone cameras, camera phones, smartphones. They had little disposable cameras with flashlights. And so all of the grandstand just lit up like a fantastic firework display. And I remember going around thinking, that's amazing. And at the same time, I'm slithering around trying to not let Michael get away. And then once we got around that bit, it was, pedal to the metal and trying not to let Michael get away from me. There was only one light that I was interested in after that, and that was his rear light, which I thought, if I lose sight of that, then he's going to get away. So what I have to do is be able to stay in touch with that.
And indeed, it is the two of you that pull away in the early stages. I think it's even the second lap, there's already quite a big gap to Jean Alesi and the pack behind. So the two of you effectively in a race of your own right from the beginning.
Yeah, there was a huge gap between, in fact, the same thing happened in Adelaide as well. But we were definitely the two guys who were in a separate battle, a separate race, I think, to the rest of them. Later on in the race, I can remember there was a big screen and I could see the battle between Nigel and John Alesi going on in the big screens as well. So I was impressed by what was going on, but they were a long way behind. Me and Michael had pretty much left everyone behind.
What was the feeling in the car at that stage of the season, Damon? Because the FW16 wasn't a great car early in the year, and I know a lot of work went into it. And obviously in the wet, you feel the problems of a car much more, and those were probably the most extreme conditions of the season. So just how difficult was it to race Michael, given that the car perhaps wasn't in the best shape, or had you got it into a good condition by that point in the season?
Well, we worked on it. We'd improved it a little bit. And but don't forget, all the cars had been butchered by the regulations, the emergency regulations that were brought in after Imola to reduce the downforce. So they all had cut off rear diffusers. So really, they were none of the cars working how they were designed to work. And but when you get into a wet race, then some of the disadvantages of a car can sometimes be negated. But certainly, if you've got, you need to have better mechanical parts of the car working. So I don't think it was the best car that year. And the Benetton was a good car. So we were pretty much evenly matched, I guess, for that race.
Just reading a line from your autobiography about this particular stage in the race, you say that I witnessed the most incredible driving display I've ever seen in a racing car. And that's your description of what Schumacher's doing, because he's still making errors, but he's still going incredibly quickly. So how was that, watching what he was up to?
Well, it is, the whole race was on another level to any other race I've ever driven. And I think it's fair to say that somehow I was in awe of Michael, as well as also deeply determined to beat him as well. So, I mean, there's been so much written about him already and how brilliant he was and this, that, and the other. And I thought, well, I've got the best seat in the house here. Everyone else is watching it on TV. I'm actually sitting right behind his gearbox and I can see exactly what he's doing. And he was getting the car all out of shape. He'd go off up the curbs. In any other situation, any other driver you'd see, they would have lost it. But he didn't. He managed to bring it back every time. And I remember just sitting there thinking, did this guy ever make a mistake, ever? You know, and I literally just thought, all I have to do, eventually it's going to fly off the road. He can't keep this up, but he just kept it up lap after lap. Absolutely astonishing. And if you look at the early onboard footages of Michael, his arms are all over the place. I mean, he really is working the wheel incredibly hard. There's a lot of correction going on, and a lot of the teammates that drove that car just couldn't handle it. But somehow he had the reflexes and the talent, I guess, to stay on top of things. And you know, there was nothing that the car could do that he couldn't deal with.
How did you feel about your own abilities in wet weather? Because I mean, we talked about Michael being a kind of rain master, and that, you know, that carried on through his career. But you had several impressive wet weather drives in your own career. And I'm thinking like Brazil 96, Monaco 96, Belgium 98. Did you always feel like, you know, some drivers feel like when the rain comes, it's going to be their day? Lewis often talks about that. Did you feel like that, or did you have to dig deeper to perform that well in the rain?
I think you go to another level in the wet because you can never relax for a second in the wet, even on the straights. It's risk. But you know, I don't think many people would desire for there to be a wet race. You know, because of the visibility, really, is the big problem. Is, you know, when it's the unpredictability is unsettling. But then once you get up into that survival mode level of concentration, then you are relying entirely on your instincts. And I often liken it to, if you remember when you're at school and you tilted back in your chair and it's about to go over, you get that kind of sudden rush of alertness and you catch it just before you fall over backwards. That's the state of alertness you're at in the wet the whole time. And you know, you can keep it up for, well, the question is actually, how long can you keep it up for? You know, to keep it up for like the great wet drives of people like Senna in Estoril, when it's actually tipping down, of course, Michael as well in Barcelona in 95. I mean, you know, stunning ability to stay on top of totally ridiculously difficult conditions. But there I was in Suzuka in that race doing exactly that. But hey, that eventually Michael started to eke away from me. And I thought the game was up.
Indeed. And then the whole race is effectively turned on its head because, as we'll come to see, Murray Walker at the very start of the race says conditions could hardly be worse, but they do get worse with what Murray describes as hail as the rain just intensifies. I mean, what was it like? I mean, it just looking on the TV, it's like it's just a wall of water effectively that you're driving into. What was that like?
Well, when it rains in Japan, it properly rains. I mean, you've got this warm water from the Pacific and it hits, everything's on a hillside in Japan. And so, you know, the moment it hits Suzuka, it's up on the hill and it just dumps everything it's got. And there was wind as well. There's quite a lot of wind around. And so I think that's the point where did Johnny lose it and then they stopped the race?
Yeah, they call a safety car or a pace car because, of course, that rule is all very new at the start, isn't it? You can sort of see that, like, it takes lap after lap of Michael leading, are you guys driving around before you catch the safety car? Whereas, of course, nowadays that it would just wait on the track somewhere for the pack to catch it up. But yeah, just before the safety car is called, Johnny Herbert loses it on the pit straight. A couple of other cars do as well. And then it quite becomes clear after that it's the race is going to have to be stopped. I think there is a restart before the red flag. Is that right?
They basically brought us to a complete stop. It wasn't a safe. Eventually, they stopped it completely and had a restart, didn't they? Yeah,
absolutely. And there's some great scenes of I don't know whether you describe it as political manoeuvring or just frustrations coming out, energy and emotion in the wet, because you've got Flavio Briatore stalking about in a backwards baseball cap that just looks absolutely hilarious. Nigel Mansell's getting in amongst it. They're all going off to see the stewards. At one point, Mick Hakkinen is pictured just running. I don't know where he's going, whether he's going to the loo or going to the stewards or whatever. But you remain in your car for the whole time during that stoppage. Is that right?
Probably did. Actually, the same thing happened in Spa. I remember, once I get in the car, I like to, once you get out of the car, you've got to go through the whole procedure of getting your mind into concentration mode. So not knowing how long it's going to take, I thought it's best to just sit here. It can get quite uncomfortable. I remember dying for a pee when I was in Spa after about, I didn't know how long it was going to go on for. It was about an hour after the start. And of course you hydrate yourself before you start the race. So I wasn't using up any fluid in perspiration. So I was, it can get uncomfortable staying in the car if you're not careful, and some drivers do relieve themselves in the car. And I want to say, make it abundantly clear that I never resorted to that. A disgusting thing to do to do that.
Impressive control.
A good bladder control. That's, I've managed to learn that much. So sitting in the car is my way of staying focused.
And then during the red flag, just watching his TV last night, it becomes clear sort of very suddenly that the sort of the rules of the race are going to be completely different. It's going to be run to an aggregate scoring system, I guess how you describe it, adding the two halves of the race or the two portions of the race together, which is obviously something very rarely seen in Formula One. I think I'm right in saying, we were just talking about this on an earlier Race of My Life podcast about Tony Brooks's career, which he won the 1959 German Grand Prix at Avis, which was deliberately two heats because they didn't know whether the cars could take the pounding on that track. Whereas this one, how was it sort of described to you? Because it's just a little bit unclear watching back how that had been arranged. Was that automatically everyone knew it was in the rules that it was just going to go right? We've had to make this red flag call. It's going to be aggregate because, of course, if you fast forward sort of nearly 15 years later or over 15 years later to Canada 2011 and Jenson Button winning, that doesn't happen. So what was your understanding going on the grid?
And I think that was made clear that it would be an aggregate two-part race. There wasn't any kind of chit-chat going on during that period. I think that we knew that. I can't remember if it was a standing stop or whether we set off behind the safety car. But anyway, Michael had a 6-second odd lead, didn't he? So that was the key point about it, was that if I was in the lead at any point, I'd still need to be plus over this 6-second odd gap over Michael. So I wasn't actually racing on the same bit of turf as Michael. I was actually racing an invisible Michael 6 seconds further down the road from where he was.
Yeah, you had to keep the gap within a certain frame, didn't you? And I think Murray's saying as you get towards the end of the race, the gap's coming down, and then you managed to have a quite strong final lap just when he's thinking, oh, maybe it's going to get a bit tight. I think Michael hit some traffic and you have a bit of a better run at the traffic, and then we hear Murray getting very excited as you come across the line and take it to one more race.
One of the problems was in the pit stop I had, they weren't able to change the tyre, and my hero of a mechanic at the time, who went on to become chief mechanic at Williams, Carl Gaydon, was on the wheel itself, and he couldn't get the thing off, so he took the instant decision to keep it on. So one of my tyres, my rear left, I think, did the entire race. It wasn't changed. It was utterly bald by the last, but you can see it in the shots in the Parc Fermé. But so there was a bit of drama there. I was totally unaware of that. They didn't even tell me. So they didn't come and go, hey, by the way, we weren't able to replace, you've only got three new tyres, basically, is what they said. They could have said, but they didn't say. And so I'm out there watching this gap coming down, Michael closing this gap, and I know I've got to stay above a certain level. And I was thinking, that should be all right. And this gap's coming down and it's getting a little bit too close for comfort. And I just thought, right, okay, I'm going to have to do something pull something out of the hat here. And I literally did say, look, Ayrton, if you're up there, I could do with a hand. Okay, I am done. I'm spent, basically. I need, and then the next thing I know, I am flying around the S's. I am literally like someone has got my foot and they stuck my foot on the accelerator to the bulkhead and it won't lift off. And I'm literally going, oh my God, I got like a stuck throttle or something. And I just drove around the S's. I got as far as Degna 2. And I was coming into the hairpin. I just thought, oh God, I can't keep this up. And I kind of, it was like I sort of consciously came back into being a little bit more cautious, and I just had to hope that would be enough, and let me know the rest.
Is this why you described it as otherworldly? When we did this interview, as many years ago now, 10, I guess, you described multiple times, actually, that it felt like an otherworldly drive or an otherworldly race. And it sort of sounds like you were going into a place mentally. I mean, Senna himself talked about going to places occasionally that you're out of body almost. Was it like that for you?
Yeah, it was. That's the only way I can describe it. There was a disconnect between what it was almost as if I let myself drive the car, my instincts drive the car. And I stopped consciously applying the brakes, applying the caution that you, your self-preservation or your perception says you need to do. Actually, we don't realize quite how able we are to do a lot of things that are physical, because we're telling ourselves, oh, we better be careful. And if you take away that, it is terrifying. I will say that, because obviously you don't know whether to trust this other guy that's driving the car or not. He could be a complete maniac, you know. but in some point you kind of go, okay, I'll let you drive for a bit, you know. And it was an astonishing experience, but it was driven by the necessity. It was driven by the competition. It was driven by the championship situation. It was driven by your competitive urge to want to win. I am not going to let anything come between me and winning this race. So you try everything. And eventually you come to the point where you, now I need inspiration from somewhere, and I found it within me somewhere, and it was just enough to beat Michael on 3 new tyres in the wet on the last lap. So I feel pretty proud about that one.
Understandably and justifiably so. I mean, you mentioned again in the book about how obviously because of the difference in fuel load, that's why he starts to sort of edge away at the start. So did you ever reassess what was going on? Because of course you had the disadvantage at that point.
Well, that was the story of our year, frankly. We just hadn't got on top of how Benetton were cleverly, you know, Ross Brawn and the team were cleverly using fuel loads to give themselves flexibility. And so we, and I think Ayrton also, we often were racing against Benetton thinking or assuming that they were on a similar fuel load. And we forgot to factor in that they were, you know, they were somewhere between 1 and 2, rather than being 1 or 2, they were somewhere in between. So, I mean, they could go either way, and they, depending on what was happening in the race. And we took us ages to work that out. I don't think we ever got on top of that until quite, you know, maybe we never got on top of it. I mean, it was just, we weren't as sharp as they were about how to use refueling.
If I just bring in another line from the Race of My Life feature that went in the magazine to ask you about, because I felt like reading it, it's quite the sort of standout line for me. Obviously, you talked about the otherworldly experience and how tremendous that was. But this line here, I felt I had justified myself as a driver in that race to the outside world and myself. And in the BBC coverage of Japan 94, they talk a lot about the criticism that you've been facing, perhaps after the result at Jerez and things like that. And you know, everything you talked about, you know, the team not being behind you, the emotion of the season. But I was interested as to why you said why yourself at the end there. Or myself, as in.
Moved to myself, yeah, because of exactly that. I mean, you know, I did not exude the confidence that Michael Schumacher did, you know, or some of the great drivers, let's be fair. You know, I wasn't confident in myself. I'd got a late entry into Formula One. I didn't get into Formula One until I was 32. I was a substitute driver, and I didn't know. You know, I knew I through the junior formula. I was put to the test. I was thrown in the deep end at the beginning of my career as a kind of alternative to racing bikes. And my first race was an absolute disaster. And I think if anyone was to look at my first effort in the car, you'd say this guy's should do something else. Yeah, really should. So I was constantly on an uphill battle, no pun intended. I was obviously fighting this late entry thing. You know, I didn't start car racing until I was 23. I didn't get to Formula One until I was 32. And now I'm fighting for a world championship when I thought I'd be teammates to Ayrton Senna and kind of, you know, Berger style, trying to, you know, do what I could or Hakkinen, you know, against this guy. So next thing I know, I'm actually fighting for world championships. So I wasn't confident. I didn't have the, I was still finding out. So I think that race underscored to me that in the heat of battle, in the, some of the toughest conditions in Formula One, in a title fight, I could do it. So yeah, it was important.
Did you ever feel that you won that argument with Williams though? Because at the end of the season, Frank is saying, oh, you know, Damon continues to surprise me. And, you know, you talked about, you know, finding this other level in yourself in Japan, and you probably carried that on into the title decider in Adelaide, because you and Michael again were, you know, well ahead. After a difficult start to the weekend, you were well ahead in the race before, obviously, the collision. But, of course, through 95 and the rest of your time at Williams, you kind of, it doesn't ever feel like the team ever really got behind you as a as an accidental number one, if you like.
It's a tough environment. I mean, they are very demanding, Frank and Patrick. They're of themselves and of their team. They want the very best. And I think if you show any weakness, then they start to doubt, you know, whether or not they've got the full package. That's why they signed Ayrton. That's why they signed Nigel. That's why they signed Alain. You know, they wanted only the best. And I readily admit I did not give them enough evidence of my my abilities on a consistent basis. Every now and then I had dropouts, and I think that they started to feel uncomfortable, and I didn't exude this confidence as well in myself, and it wasn't my way. And if I was to, you know, if I was to advise any driver coming into Formula One now, I would say, you know, if you show any sign of weakness, you show any sign of self-doubt, it will be used against you. Do not expect people to come to your rescue or your aid if you appear to be slightly different about things.
Damon, sort of taking that thought on a little bit, if you don't mind, about talking about 2020 Formula One. We know we've got two drivers who know that they're leaving the teams they haven't even started the season with yet at the end of the year. So you've got Carlos Sainz Jr. at McLaren and Sebastian Vettel at Ferrari. And thinking about 96 and your championship win, and obviously it became clear that you would be leaving at the end of the year, but you still had to go in with a title fight and deliver against Jacques Villeneuve. What's it like racing for a team, and what can they expect knowing that they're going to be out at the end of the year? Okay, on sort of amicable terms, particularly with Carlos Sainz, Sebastian Vettel, perhaps slightly differently, we don't know. What's it going to be like for them this upcoming season, do you reckon?
Basically, it's a bit like in politics. If you announce you're not going to run for election,
lame duck prime minister,
or a dead man walking, or you know, all these expressions. You know, it is literally the world just switches immediately to the future. You know, they'll put an arm around you and they'll go, "Oh, it's jolly nice of you to stay," but they can't. You know, they might, if they're very generous, sort of give you a going away present or something like that. I think even more difficult is announcing you're going to stop driving. I mean, I saw Kimi announce that it might be this last season or whatever. When I made the decision I wanted to stop, to carry on thinking I just need to get through these last five races is very difficult. And Bernie, whatever you think of Bernie, you know, he has got insight, extraordinary insight into human nature. And he said, when a driver sees the red light, he needs to stop immediately. And I think that is absolutely true. If you think you haven't got it, don't carry on until the end of the season. Stop right there and then. Vettel's situation is a bit worrying for him, because I mean, he's announced he's not going to be with Ferrari. They announced he's not going to be with Ferrari, but where's he going to be? And he's not going to drive for Aston Martin, or why would he do that? So when you get to the top, it's very difficult, because the only way is down, and there's no more top anymore if you're leaving.
Yeah, he's not in control of his own destiny, I suppose. That's the thing. He can't go into the season thinking, oh, well, you know, I've got my one. In Sainz's case, he thinks, well, I've got my last year with McLaren, and then I'm going on to this, you know, big new world at Ferrari, a step up. Whereas in Vettel's case, he's on almost the slide, and it's very hard to have the same kind of mindset and go for that absolute last percent when you know you haven't got a new positive horizon necessarily to look towards.
I think that's where someone like Jackie Stewart's astuteness shines through as well. He knew exactly when to quit. He didn't go to 100 races. He went to 99 and went, that's it. Niki Lauda, when he stopped the first time as well, there's an understanding they have of how the world works and how things work in in Formula One or in business or in politics. And you've got to know when to stop and also probably not announce it until, you know. But one of the problems is actually being able to get out of contracts. So, you know, to actually sort of, if you've signed up, you can't just suddenly go, well, I'm not doing it anymore, because you might get yourself into financial problems with breach of contract and stuff. You know, they might say, well, we've signed you for, what are we going to do? We want the money back or whatever. I don't know. Yeah.
You were sort of pretty emphatic in the feature in Autosport back in 2010 about the 94 Japanese Grand Prix, understandably being the race of your life. But were there any other races you might have put up there, or perhaps were just behind this one? Any in particular? I've got a list of suggestions from our editor Kevin Turner to go through with you if you want.
Adelaide 94.
The next one, yep, the very next one.
I mean, that was Suzuka Part Two, until it all went wrong. So the astonishing thing was we set off from Adelaide, and it was just like we literally put the cars in a crate, flown from Japan, landed in Adelaide, and they just carried on racing on a different track. Admittedly, it was dry and wasn't wet, but you know, the pace of that race was intense. That was so intense. And the thing for me is that Michael, I did put him under pressure because he pushed himself to go to make the break, but eventually he went off. And you know, he overdrove to get it to stay ahead of me.
Yeah, he made He made the mistake, I guess, in Adelaide that he didn't make in Suzuka when you were watching him.
Yeah, quite possibly so, Ben. I think maybe my assessment was right that you can only keep up that level for so long, and eventually something's going to give, and it certainly did in Adelaide. But there was no consolation. You know, for that, because he even when he's only got one arm behind his back, you know, he's still a dangerous competitor.
What was the atmosphere like at Williams, Damon? You talked about Patrick Head coming up to you after qualifying at Suzuka and pointing this out, and I think you say in your book, just said it in your head, okay, sod you then, and then leads this fantastic performance at Suzuka. But what was the atmosphere at the team like during the title decider in the run up to what happened in Australia?
I want to emphasize this because I've got a lot of affection for Frank and for Patrick, and I I've got a lot to be thankful to them for as well. But it is, you know, there are times when what is said at the time has an effect, and you know, I think Patrick thought he was motivating me by giving me a rollicking occasionally. And it did motivate me, but it was a negative motivation. So my motivation is, look, okay. I remember once in Spa, he had a moment where he was a bit frustrated and came and gave me a talking to. And this was in the like first 10 minutes of the first session on a Friday, I think. And so he came in and he had a go at me. And I remember thinking, what the hell, where did that come from? So I took the steering wheel off and just gave it to him. I said, here, you drive. And then he went off in the huff and... but then that's all part of the fun of the game. We all love each other and we all actually want the best out of each other, but every now and then we snap and bark at each other, and it can be quite amusing.
What was the atmosphere like during the Adelaide weekend in the team?
Yeah, the Adelaide weekend got off to a very bad start because I've been to Barry Sheen's and Barry was banging on to me. We flew down from Brisbane down to Adelaide, had been banging on at me about my contract for the following year because I started the season as a number two and now I should be, you know, paid what I was worth. And so he managed to convince me that I was underpaid and underprivileged and all the rest of it. And I got off the plane and launched into this tirade to Murray Walker about how Williams didn't appreciate me. And then it all went a bit pear-shaped. And then I went into the garage and I saw Patrick and I was so embarrassed. Honestly, it was so, there they are waiting to receive their driver. And he's just told them that he's not appreciated by the team. So I made many gaffes as a fledgling Formula One driver in that position. And you live and learn.
Well, the timing might've been poor, but he was right, wasn't he? Shane, because you know I think Mansell was on a contract for his selected appearances that eclipsed the amount that you were being paid for the whole season. So you must have had some grounds for feeling a little bit aggrieved, considering that you were heading into that race with a chance of the championship.
Maybe so, but negotiating in public like that wasn't so wise.
What about your title win at Suzuka in 1996? Where would that rank on a list of your great races? Obviously, you know.
It was a relatively straightforward drive. I mean, quite frankly, you know, Michael wasn't in a competitive car. He was there somewhere, but Jack was the only person who had the beat and his wheel fallen off. So it was pretty straightforward. That's not to say that it was, you know, of course, the tension before that was massive. But once it was resolved, once Jacques was out, you know, I just had to get the thing home, and it was quite enjoyable in some ways. Except, of course, I did say to when they said that Jacques is out, you're world champion. I did come back with, I said, do I have to carry on? And they said something like, "Yeah, we'd like you to win the race as well if you can do that." So easy race as far as they can be.
It must have been a big relief, though, because I think the races leading up to that had been quite tough. You'd had that, you know, Monza race where you were leading, and those weird tyre stacks, I think, caught you out. And then, obviously, Jacques had a great performance in Estoril, and you had a reasonable gap in the points. I mean, the pressure was building into a situation that would have then also been new for you as well. And we saw even drivers like Michael have a bit of a choke on the title decide, even when it's almost done. So it must have been a hard weekend, nevertheless.
Yeah, the Monza one was actually, it was almost like the opposite of a choke. I was flying. I did this great pass on Alesi, and they had these tyres on the chicanes, and I'd managed to get it beautifully. You know, the car was so nimble that I could just slither through the tyres when I was pushing. And then once I got a bit of a lead, I remember saying to myself, okay, don't push it now, Damon, just, you know, back off a bit. And of course, the moment I backed off, instead of sliding, it gripped. And it turned in about a foot earlier than it had been, and I just hit the tyres. So actually going slower has often been proven in Formula One. Actually backing off creates a problem, which I think is what happened to Senna at Portier in Monaco, where the moment you back off, the car behaves differently, and you can get your lines all wrong. Anyway, yeah, one or two bumps in the road, as you know, as you rightly say. It's never a plain sailing. This year's championship is going to be curious, because if they have a reduced number of races, it's going to be flat out every race, isn't it? It's going to be you're not going to get a chance to see whether or not there's a trend through the season. There's not going to be any development, so I think it's going to be quite an unusual kind of championship, this one.
Damon, what about, can we please get your thoughts on the 1997 Hungarian Grand Prix, that famous race for Arrows, where it was all set up for a famous victory and then it got snatched away from you at the last minute? How was that from your perspective?
Yeah, well, it was a fantastic weekend where we were blessed by a poor tyre decision by Goodyear, partly, and some of the Goodyear runners had used the softer tyre compound. And Bridgestone, you know, we I always thought were a fantastic tyre. They always made this very reliable kind of, it had a kind of rigidity to the tread, which enabled you to push it. And I'm not saying Goodyear were bad tyres at all. They were good too. But Bridgestone's got it right. And we were the only ones who had it in Hungary that weekend. And we managed to get a balance, didn't need a very powerful engine at Hungary. It was twistier than it is now, actually. And we had a great qualifying, and Michael couldn't get off the corners, and after a few laps his tyres were finished, and so I managed to get past him and made the break. And after about 20 laps, I thought, well, this has been a fantastic weekend. You know, we never expected this much with Arrows, frankly. So leading the race, that was good enough for me. But to get within one lap of the end and then for something to happen was a little bit cruel. But at least we got to the finish. That's the only thing you can say about it.
Absolutely. Ben, can I bring you in here? Any races you might want to ask Damon about or suggest that would have been up there in a race of my life discussion?
Well,
the Hungary is the one that gets talked about. If I, you know, people, when they refer to my career, they talk about that one almost more than any other race. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, I could imagine so. I mean, as a fan in that period as a kid growing up, I mean, that it did stand out to me because obviously the car you're in was a backmarker car for most of the season. So for you to suddenly be, I mean, I thought if, you know, if Dane was going to finish in the points or even on the podium, that would be amazing. And like you said, you know, you, it was so unexpected. You were happy once you'd taken the lead. But, you know, if that, I think if what had happened hadn't happened and you'd managed to do that extra lap and win that race, I think that would, you know, it would probably far and away outrank just because it was so unexpected. But you had, I think you had a few races that were unlikely. You know, I think Spa 98, I know everyone talks about the kind of team orders thing at the end and calling Ralph off, but you know, you qualified really well in the dry. I think you split the McLarens and the Ferraris that weekend.
Yeah. And the car was fantastic that weekend. You know, it was, it's always the fundamental car design has always been suited to Spa, hasn't it? That the Jordan seemed to be, anyway, it came good that weekend for a lot of reasons. And the Ralph thing, added a bit of drama. I mean, it was drama right from the word go. So it wasn't quite as long as Canada, the Button win in Canada, but it was quite a long week, you know, afternoon, that one, and very cold and wet.
Yeah. And also I think Monaco 96, that was a race that stood out to me. I know it didn't end well, but you know, given the particular history of that circuit in your family, to have that, you know, that performance again in the rain, very difficult conditions at a circuit like Monaco, I think that's the real one that got away, other than maybe Hungary 97. I thought that performance stood out as well in your career.
That was the one time that I remember that we got, as a team with Williams, we got the tyre change absolutely spot on. We actually finally did it. We got it right. And then the Renault engine dropped its sump plug or something. Anyway, so tough one. Not had too much success, Williams, at Monaco.
I think that was a real shame, that one. I think, you know, I felt like you were, that was one of the, well, that year, obviously, you started extremely well and you had a impressive performance in Brazil, which is, again, another mixed conditions race. But, yeah, I felt like Monaco, you were kind of, you know, really in the groove.
Well, I think you can look at some races and go, okay, well, I did my job, you know, as well as I could. And it was really going well in Monaco. There are other experiences like qualifying laps that you did. I think it was 95, the qualifying lap with Monaco was really out of this world for me. It was a fantastic lap. Another one at the Nürburgring I did, which was, I was reminded of that qualifying lap. I think it was 96, by Dario Franchitti said, he said, that lap was a good lap. And I remember thinking about it. It was absolutely one of those laps where you just go, everything just, you could lean on the car and just squeeze out every last drop of the performance. So satisfying to just get those one lap experiences. So I had a lot of experiences in a very relatively short career compared to what they do nowadays. I mean, they're normally out there for 14 years or more. So race of my life would say is still Suzuka. Some great other experiences like Monaco, as you said, and Hungary, and Spa 98, which was, I don't think I could have, you know, expected. I certainly didn't expect anything like that kind of career when I first started in Formula 1. I had no idea what to expect.
Absolutely. Well, you've thankfully taken away my having to introduce the awkward bit where I pretend that I'm going to disagree or don't disagree with your choice. But of course, having you on here was going to be my question, was do you still pick Suzuka 1994 as the race of my life? But clearly you do. And it just, again, I think underlines that significance. First of all, what a great drive it was, but just what it means to you.
Yeah, I think it was a defining event. I think set up the title showdown. It stops the steamroller from Michael and Benetton. They had to pack up all their party poppers and their balloons and everything and take them to Adelaide. They still got a chance to use them, but it was drama. You know, it was 94, was very, very high drama, high stakes, very emotional season. And I think it all went into that. For me, all the energy went into that performance in Suzuka in the wet.
Damon, thank you so much for coming on the Race of My Life podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you this morning. So yes, thank you very much for your time. Thank you, Ben, as well.
Thanks to Autosport. I hope the listeners enjoy. Every time I revisit these races, I get the emotions back. And so excuse me if I sound overexcited, but you do start to go back to that time. And it's phenomenal to recount them. So thank you very much.
I'm going to start leaning back on my chair and see how long I can can balance.
Don't try this at home, Ben.
Well, thank you again for listening to this episode of Race of My Life, and thanks again to Damon and Ben for their time. Did you enjoy the episode and hearing Damon's insights on his drive and wider career? Let us know on our social media channels using the handle @autosport, and do check out Damon's full Race of My Life feature on autosport.com. We'll be back soon with another episode of Race of My Life.